Welcome back to the Unlearning of Child Welfare podcast. If you listen to episode 5, you know this is the second part of the conversation about creating a more just and equitable child welfare system with Kerry Washington, Sharonda Selivanoff, Jessica Crisp, Matt Anderson, Jerry Milner, and myself, Jaquia Wilson. Let's pick up right where Kerry left off.
I'm curious to hear from our panelists how you all think that we create a more just and equitable experience for children and families, and what's the role of the youth, parent, and family leadership in creating that experience? So what are our action steps?
As we create space for families, we have to be able to open up and recognize that each one of them has a need, and are we willing to actually answer that? So as we concede space and we share power and we have a collective understanding, what I think happens is we build a community so that people can do things that they didn't even think were possible. I think that as we continuously concede that space and concede that power, and I actually want to just say it's shared, right? It's a space where each one of us comes with something to give, and we're here to learn and grow with one another. I think that the more that we recognize, and I think earlier someone said, you know, we don't know what's best for families. Man, I need the same thing you do, right? I need food. I need wheels. I need some money in my pocket, right? I need shelter. Like, that's just universal. As we start to create that equitable experience, right, we've got to actually be able to afford those things too, right, that are universal for each one of us. And if someone doesn't have those things, how are we getting them to those things? I think the way that some of these systems are set up is we have the bare necessities as rewards, right? Food is not a reward. It's essential. Housing is not a reward. It's essential. The more that you bring the youth, the parent, and any person that has an experience to the table, what you're actually saying to them in that moment is, I value you, right? I value you are worth it. You are equal. You have something to offer here, and your voice needs to be here, because I don't know how you know more about my life than I do. I'm living it, right? Like, I'm living it. So we have got to create the space so that people that are having the experience, not only are they telling you about it, but you're taking that information and you're doing something with it, right? You've got to take that space. You've got to include people in it. You have to be able to take the information, drive that back into the community so that you can be responsive to the needs of what people said. But once again, I don't think that this is rocket science. I think at the core of this is it becomes down to deserving and undeserving. And I think that we are founded on a nation that has separated us, and that it is prime time. For us to do something different. If you look at anything in the 1800s, I'm going to tell you what, none of those things exist, because we have advanced as a species, right? And we have taken that learning and we have continued to invent and innovate. Love, care, and compassion was foundational in 1800, and it's foundational in 2020. Please let your actions drive that, and know that none of this has changed, right? The problem is we're not changing. We have too much information for us not to. So it becomes deliberate. And I hope that each one of us takes the opportunity to recognize that families, that children, that parents, that kinship, that grandmothers, they just want to be able to take care of their families. And if they don't have the resources or the wherewithal to do it, then let us be the call, because I'm here to serve you, not myself.
Oh, that's so powerful. And your truth is always so beautiful. And I think really hearing you speak, just the word servant leadership come to mind and how critical that is in doing this work. And I love the way that you talk about communities and the way that they have to wrap around our families. Jessica, you've been so steeped into that work of really showing up for your community. Would love to hear from you.
Thank you. Sorry, my screen was freezing for just a second. Sharonda, that was incredible. And I would love to answer, Kerry, as you're saying, and jump off of what Sharonda was saying. I believe in, as Sharonda was saying, the basic necessities of kindness and compassion that need to drive everything that we're doing. And in turn, what that will lead us to are things that we did not know we were capable of. And I feel like that is, those are some of those aha moments that are life-changing. And for our family, what that looked like was over a year and a half of building a relationship. But to me, what this looks like as far as being a just and equitable system is that the day that our little one was reunified with her joyful extended family, that was not the end. And if we show kindness and compassion through this process to these family members, you cannot help but join together. Even if you have nothing else in common with people, you will find common ground. And it allows you in the end to have these long relationships or the potential for some type of long involvement, which allows support structures to remain in place. One thing that I feel so strongly about that is so difficult is realizing the day reunification happens for that family, that means any other support structure is pretty much gone. For the most part, the foster family would say, goodbye, we're done, the child's home, okay, we're stepping away. But what they really need is someone in our situation who left a 10-month-old and then suddenly one day becomes the parent of a 3-year-old with not much time in between to be able to navigate all of it. There had to be a way to help her as her mother know that she could feel confident in this role and that we also believed in her and that we would help carry her through this process. So if anyone had said before, hey, you're going to end up with a 3-4 year plus relationship with this family that you met through foster care, would that happen? I would say there's no way that's going to happen because everyone wants to kind of close the door on that part of their life that's so hard. But what's happened here is it's become a normal part of our family now. And we have the opportunity with our little one and her family and extended family. We see them regularly. We do birthdays together. We do baby showers together. We do all of these things together. And all of this came out of not me being an amazing person, because honestly, I'm not. This came out of the fact that we showed kindness and compassion to someone in their time of need. And what you can see is that you're able to help nurture something in the end that allows these individuals who are stuck in this really horrible, painful system, they're able to thrive in a way in the end. And if we continue to stand by them and build a community that, as Sharonda was saying, carries them, carry me, let's carry one another, because together we can do this. Separately, if we pull out all the scaffolding, the cycle can continue and we've got to stop how this continues to roll. So if we want to put the brakes on that, we've got to join together in that way and practically live out that compassion, live out that empathy and tell people respectfully, I hear you, you are heard, you are seen, we can do this together.
And I love what you said that, you know, when we do this, it leads us to things we didn't know we had the capacity to hold. And that I think your family is such a great example of growing your capacity to love in a new way, growing your capacity and your understanding of what family looks like and what family means. And you all are certainly an example of what it looks like to build a longer table. And as we're all talking today, it's like, I get this image of for too long in child welfare, we've played musical chairs where we're ripping chairs away when we can't afford to do that any longer. We need more people to be wrapping around these families and these children. So thank you for that answer. And I'd love to transition to Jerry as someone who's in a leadership role. What does this look like for you?
From a more organizational perspective and how I perceive the leadership role in this area, to get to a more just and equitable experience, we've got to get serious about what our vision is. Just like Matt said earlier, he has to unlearn what his job is. I think we have to unlearn what our vision is. Our vision has to address whole families. This is not unusual, but earlier today, I heard a state child welfare leader expounding a very well-intentioned vision that essentially is a rescue the child approach. And never once did I hear anything about strengthening families, strengthening communities, supporting families to care for their children. That's more typical than not. And it hasn't changed, to be quite honest, in half a century. And that kind of a vision has not gotten us to where we want to go or where our families want and need to go. The vision has to be stronger families who can care for their children, stronger communities. And then we can get serious about how to implement that vision, because vision without action is just a bunch of words that don't really mean anything. A few people have noted funding to get to a better experience for children. Our funding has to match our vision and our goals. If foster care is our goal, Matt has alluded to this, our funding matches it perfectly right now because that's what we can spend money on. If prevention is our goal, if strengthening families is our goal, then our funding does not match that goal at all. Our current funding, to be very blunt, essentially a bet against our most vulnerable families, our most overrepresented children and families. We need the flexibility to be able to meet their needs as they define those needs, where they are, not only kindness and compassion, but also with justice so that they have full benefit of what the system can offer and provide to them. Central to all of this is our capacity to listen to the voices of parents, youth, children, and to act on those voices. As I said earlier, we cannot, should not presume to know their experiences if we've not walked in those shoes. And we have to integrate the opportunities, I should say, for their voices in all of our work on an ongoing basis. It can't be just tokenism. It can't be review and comment on things that we've already done. It has to be an integrated, ongoing way of doing our work. And I don't think it's a system we have really given in ourselves to sharing that power, as Sharonda has made such eloquent reference to already. I think part of the way we get to a better system is we have to give up the notion that child welfare has to be the face of everything that involves our children and our families. We have to embrace our prevention partners, our community members, or the organizations, formal and informal, as equal partners in creating the kind of child and family well-being system that can serve our families well. That involves surrendering so much of that power that Sharonda has already mentioned to communities, to families, to design the kinds of systems that will best meet their needs, and then have the utter guts to go after the kind of funding that's needed to support those programs, rather than staying married to unlimited foster care at the expense of supporting families. David and I visited last year with a family support center in the Bronx that was just being kicked off in a particular community there. One of the things that I took away from that is that they won't offer new services through the family support center, even if they sound like a good idea, without the concurrence of the community who will be the recipient of those services. I admire that kind of commitment so much there. I think that we have to, we've made references to this, if we want to get to a different experience, we have to organize at the national, the state, the local level to address seriously the relationship between poverty and the number one reason that children enter our foster care system, which is neglect. We have to come to the understanding that even financially poor parents can be good parents to their children. Many times, as others have already noted, they need those concrete basic supports in order to do what needs to be done for their children. But we have got to address that relationship and stop sweeping that under the rug and blaming our parents for not having all the resources that they actually need.
Thank you for that, Jerry. Thank you. Thank you. And the vision without action is just a bunch of words really stood out to me. And I love what you said about there needs to be shared power. There needs to be shared vision. That's really what's going to carry us into a more intentional place where we don't have tokenization anymore, where we have families that feel well supported and feel safe to come be vulnerable and say what they need, and that you have communities that step up to show up for them. And I know that Matt is such a big visionary and he speaks about vision a lot. So Matt, would love to hear your thoughts here.
I'm not going to talk about vision so much, actually. I want to share some more concrete things, I hope anyway, but it is important to have vision, and vision has to be followed by leadership, and that leadership has to be equitable, right? Diverse, equitable leadership. The most diverse teams are the most successful, right? So build your teams with diversity in mind to get the job done better and faster and in a more just way, I would say. And I would encourage everybody, you know, take these conversations into your own organizations, your own communities, and find ways to do the next steps of the action. But I think there are a few things that come to mind about how do we create a more just and equitable system. And so one, I think it's incredibly simple that we can all start doing today. And it starts with language. So let's start using parents and family instead of bio parents and bio mom and biological thing. I think as soon as we use the term bio mom, we have made mom other and we have separated her on a much deeper level than distance from her children, for her and for her children and for us. I don't think it's healthy for us to refer to parents as biological parents. I would suggest let's start using parents. Like Sharonda said, you know, parents love their children and their children love their parents. And sometimes it's not a safe, healthy relationship and we intervene, but that doesn't change the fact that they love each other. And we need to really start to use different language. I think, you know, Jessica, I don't think Jessica's a foster parent. You know, technically she's licensed as a foster parent, but maybe she's a parent success coach. And maybe we should use terms like that, that really describe the goal that we have in mind, you know, in terms of the role that somebody like Jessica plays. Another thought is there's a new toolkit that just came out. Children's Trust Fund Alliance and QPI and Youth Law Center and Casey. So I would take a look at that. And it's a reunification shared parenting toolkit. So let's implement practices that empower our staff and empower our parent success coaches to help parents reunify with their children. Let's really start to implement some new practices and we can start doing that. I think that, you know, how do we create a more just and equitable system? Well, if we have an unjust system, you know, it was probably designed to be that. And I don't know if anybody on this call designed it to be that way. I don't think that's true, but it was designed to be that way. So let's design it to be just and equitable. And I think we can all start doing that even in our own organization. So I think we can think about what is our practice? How have we organized our practice? And what decisions have we made about how we go about doing our work? And or are we just doing the things that we've always done? And do we need to step back? And it's hard because foster care is a crisis-driven, under-resourced, overworked profession. It's the hardest job in the world. But we still have to take time to step back and rethink and redesign the work that we do in a way that's more just and more equitable, that's maybe not built on white middle class values. And it's an inclusive process to redesign our work. And so if you have a table where you're going to redesign your work, you know, take Carrie's analogy and stretch the table longer. Make sure you have a diverse team. Make sure there are parents, there are youth, there are all kinds of stakeholders at your table helping you design the work that you're doing. And then commit to it, right? A lot of us as organizations do plans and we have really nice plans, but we don't always follow through on our plans. So, you know, design your practice, be committed to your practice and really follow through on what you're trying to do. I think those are some things that we can do, you know, but I think at the same time, you know, these conversations have focused a lot on how are we going to prevent foster care in the first place? And I think, you know, we all have to have that front and center. I don't know if that's the job alone of child welfare to prevent foster care in the first place. I think, you know, we've heard it, Jerry and others have said it. We need to be partnering together or we need to be advocating on behalf of ourselves and the families that we serve and kind of ringing the alarm bell of the public health crisis that I think foster care is. And, you know, letting folks know that we're concerned about the families that we serve and we want to see, you know, we want to see the funds liberated to do different kind of work. We want to see partnerships coming together to prevent and strengthen families. And I think we can do that. We can do that as child welfare folks. You know, we can raise those concerns. So those are some things that we can do.
Thank you, Matt. Yes, so many good things in there. Language matters so much and changing the narrative, changing the way that we do this work. Always so grateful for your leadership and the work that you're doing with the Institute for Family. And we are grateful for everyone's answers. And I think as we look ahead to 2021, we're in this month where everyone starts to get their vision boards ready and their New Year's resolutions ready. So as we do start thinking about those things, let's keep this at the forefront.
Thank you all so much.
All right. That rounds out the Unlearning of Child Welfare podcast. And I want to take some time to thank every single co-host and panelist who joined me in this important conversation. Please share this podcast with your family, friends, and colleagues. And go to www.instituteforfamily.org to learn more about what we're doing to help redefine what family well-being means. Stay tuned for more podcasts to come.